कर्णेभिश्विनुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षिभिर्यजत्राः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षिभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Let's start from verse 1. Repeat after me. We'll do chant verse 1 and 2. I'm going to talk a little bit more about these two verses, and then we'll go into verse 3.
Okay.
I want you to repeat after me. I'm going to chant it.
Verse 1?
Mm-hmm. And verse 2.
Page 7.
Well, does it say verse 1 on there? Om Iti Ye Kud.
7.
Oh, we still don't have the transliteration. That's because I've been too busy. I'll get that. So just, I'll say it in short sections. You just repeat. Om iti etad aksharam idam sarvam. Om iti etad aksharam idam sarvam. Tasya upavyakhyanam. Tasya upavyakhyanam. Bhutam bhavat bhavishat iti. Bhutam bhavat bhavishat iti sarvam omkaraha eva sarvam omkaraha eva yatcha yatcha anyat vikalatitam tadapi omkaraha eva. Next verse. Sarvam yetad, sarvam yetad, brahma ayam atma, brahma ayam atma, brahma soyam atma, brahma soyam atma, chatushpat, chatushpat. So these three we're working on last week, but I still have a little bit more that I just want to clarify, and then we'll go to the next. So going back to verse 1. The syllable, the letter om. Akshara means letter or syllable. So om iti aksharam. This syllable, this sound syllable, this letter, om, right, is idam sarvam. The letter om is all of this. So sarvam means all. This means all that is in your experience. Another way of saying it. The om, syllable om, the sound syllable om, this letter om, is all of this, the entire creation. Everything that exists within time and space. Om is the abhidhana for. You have these two terms, abhidhana and abhideya. Abhidhana means the name of something. The abhideya is the thing which is named. So om, the syllable om is the abhidhana, is the name for everything that is, for all that is. So then he says, so tasya upavyakhyanam, we're going to the upavyakhyanam of this, the description or the explanation of this. This is what we're going to be describing or explaining. Bhut begins with, is understood, it's not in here, but it's understood from the Bhasha, puts it in. The the analysis or the explanation, the unfoldment of this Omkara begins with Bhutam Bhavat Bhavishyat Iti Sarvam Omkara Eva. So this is how it begins. What is the past? The Bhutam, everything in the past. The Bhavat, everything now in the present. Bhavishyat, and everything in the future. Past, present, future. Bhutam, Bhavat, Bhavishyat. Past, present, and future. Iti Sarvam Omkara Eva. All of it is Omkara alone. Om is the name for all of it. Not just what is here now, what has been here in the past, what will be here in the future. Om is the name for all of it. So all that exists, past, present, and future, on every level. Okay? That is Om. And then he says, just to make sure, Yetcha anyat trikalatitam, and that which is beyond past, present, and future, that which is other than past, present, or future. So when he says that, the anyat, that which is beyond time, is actually the karana, that which is causal to the time. So that would be the whole maya upadi, the causal ajnana upadi, the karana. Karana means causal. So the causal state from which all of this comes, right, that also. Right? That which is not objectified into past, present, and future, which we can't see, but is causal to all of that, the karana sharira, that also is omkaraha. You could also say Brahman. Brahman, and we'll see that. Brahman, which is also not subject to past, present, and future, but is the very self of past, present, future, the very truth of past, present, future, that also is the self in the past, in the present, and the future, but the causal, the cause from which this projection comes, that also is not, has no time or no differentiation in it. So the past, present, future, all of that is Om, and everything beyond that too. Three kala, the word three means three, kala means time, three kala atitam. Atitam means beyond, right? That which is beyond past, present, and future. So all of this is the Omkara. So now with this verse, the name, the Abhidhanam, you know, the Abhidhana is being described. But now the thing is, the relationship we have to look at between the Abhidhana, the name, and the Abhideya, the thing that is named, that's very important. Because if the Abhidhana has a reality of its own in any way, separate from the Abhideya, the thing which is being named, then we have duality. And so we have to understand what is really the relationship between the nama, the name, the Abhidhana, and the object which is being named. So let's do the next verse so that I can talk a little bit more about these two before we go on. So all we know right now is the Om is the name for all that exists. So this verse is from the standpoint of the Abhidhana. So the Om is the name for all the things that exist. But now he's going to say from the standpoint of the Abhideya, the thing which is being named. So he says again, look at verse 2. Sarvam hi etad. Indeed, all of this is Brahman. All of this, which is Om, all of this is Brahman. So now we have the Brahman is the Abhideya, the thing which Om is a name of. Okay? So he says, Sarvam hi etad Brahma. All that is, all of this, indeed he, is Brahman. And then he says, Ayam Atma, this self, this Aparoksha Atma, this self which is immediately present as me, this Atma, this self, is Brahman. Okay? Brahman is all that is. Everything that is, which is named Om. And this Brahman, which is everything, this Brahman is Atma. Brahman is this Atma. This is an important word because there's a difference between this and that, these two words. That shows distance. This is closer. So this is what is what we call pratyaksha, what is immediately present for my experience. When we usually say the word pratyaksha, we mean that which I'm perceiving through my sense perception immediately. Like all of you are pratyaksha. You're immediately being experienced by me through my sense organs. Paroksha would be anything that's beyond the realm of my sense organs. So it's there and I may know about it, but it's not here immediately present for my immediate experience. That's called paroksha. The Atma falls into the realm, the Atma, yourself, your being, falls into the realm of that which is immediately experienced. But it's not something your being, your amness, the conscious being that you are, is not experienced as an object. It's not experienced through sense perception. You would say, oh, look at the conscious being that I am. It's not something that can be objectified through sense perception. Also, conscious being is not the conscious being yourself, the very nature of the I. The I would be the Abhidhana. The aham would be the Abhidhana. For the Abhideya, which would be the Atma. See what I mean? So if I say, I am, the word I, is a word that is referring to, it is a name for me, the self. And so this self that we're talking about is as we'll see as we go on, is the conscious being. And so this conscious being that makes me me, here it says, Brahman is all of this, and this Brahman, and Brahman is, I am Atma, it says, I am Atma Brahman. This Atma is Brahman. So this, when I say this Atma, we're talking about something that is immediately present, and you have to say, I am immediately present. You can't say that I am, you know, away from my experience, because I am always the very center of my experience. I can't have an experience without me being there. And yet, even though I am self-evident, you know, the experience is self-evident, self-luminous, as just the I that is central to all experience, this self, the Atma, is not something that can be objectified with my mind and my sense organs. So, because if I could, then I would be an object to who? In subject-object relationship, who would be the subject then? If I illumine the Atma as an object. But if I don't illumine, if the Atma yourself is not illumined as an object, and yet it is known without a knower, then, because it's not illumined, then we say it's self-evident. Because if we say it's known without a knower, what does that mean? Well, it means that it itself is self-evident. It doesn't require subject-object relationship to shine. So consciousness, if you just think about it really, consciousness can't require another consciousness to illumine it. That doesn't make any sense. So you have consciousness, this is conscious because I'm conscious of it, and this consciousness is conscious because I'm conscious of it. It's an infinite regress. And so your being is, in a sense, the bottom line. It is the self-evident consciousness which illumines all other things. Itself not being illumined. When that is the case, we say, we can't say that's pratyaksha, that's an object of your experience. It is the very nature of the subject. So we say it's aparoksha. So pratyaksha means I'm experiencing it immediately through as a vritti, a thought modification in the mind, or as a sense object. Paroksha, aksha, just to understand this a little bit, aksha means your eyes or your sense organs. Pratyaksha, pratyaksha, means that which is near, that which is around your sense organs. Aksha really means eyes, but it stands for all the sense organs. So pratyaksha, pratyaksha, that which is surrounding your sense organs. So you have immediate experience. Paraksha, paroksha, from paras, paroksha, paraksha. It's a paras, it takes the visarga become also paroksha. That means that which is away from my sense organs. So pratyaksha, paroksha, but I'm not pratyaksha. I'm not within as a sense object to myself, But I'm also not known. I'm not away from my experience either. So then we say, aparoksha. In Sanskrit, the a negates. Like if a word begins with a consonant and I put an a in front of it, it indicates it. So paroksha means it's beyond sense perception. It's away from my sense perception. Aparoksha means it's not away from my sense perception. So the aparoksha, so we'll say this sentence, the aparoksha atma, right, it's compound, the aparoksha atma, right, is Brahman. And Brahman is all that is. So this conscious being that I am, that is the one who is present, the center, to all experience. I'm the one without me. If you take away yourself, then where's there any experience? You are the bottom line as the conscious being because of whom there is experience. Otherwise, nothing is known. Without consciousness, no experience is known. Whether it's a mental experience, an emotional experience, you know, the buddhi, an intellection, a memory, or a perception, whatever the experience may be, a meditative experience. Say if you're meditating and you have all different types of subtle and beautiful experiences, or boring ones, whatever they are, when you're contemplating. Whatever the experience, that experience is taking place in me. I'm the conscious being because of which that experience is known. And that's a constant, right? So that Atma, which itself is not an object of knowledge, but is swaprakasha, means it's self-shining. Prakasha means shining. It's a swaprakasha. It is its own luminosity. That's one word we use, swaprakasha. Swatasiddham. Swatasiddha means it's self-established. It's self-evident. Swatasiddha. Siddha means that which is established, that which is evident. Swataha siddham, swata siddha, that which is itself evident. It is, you know, this, how we say in English, it is self-evident, means there's nothing illumining it. So this swata siddha, swaprakasha, atma, aparoksha, atma, is Brahman, and Brahman is all this. And then he says, so, ayam atma brahma. And then he says, saha ayam atma chatushpat. He says, that Brahman, which is this atma, saha ayam atma, saha goes back to Brahman, that Brahman, which is this atma, so saha ayam atma, that this atma. When I say, in Sanskrit, when you say something like, saha ayam, that this, saha that, and it's all masculine, Atma is masculine, Brahman is neuter, that's why I'm saying this technical point. That this Atma. That this Atma means this Atma, which now has been revealed to be Brahman. We've just talked about that, so this Atma, which is that, you know, so that this Atma, which you've discovered to be Brahman, this Atma, which is aparoksha, which is immediately present as me, is chatushpat. It has four matras. It has four quarters, okay? Four padas. So the four padas, when we say that it has four padas, there's something to be understood here, that if Om is the Abhidhana, is the name for Brahman, and Brahman is everything, Brahman, which is everything, is this Atma, okay? So, and this Atma has four padas. It means it has four parts, four sections, as though. Okay. Then Om also, being a name for Brahman, which is this Atma, it also must have four matras. Matras means letters, you know. So the Omkara will have four matras, that will match the four padas, the four states of experience that make up Brahman. Okay? And Brahman, so you can see this, when we say Brahman is all of this, and the Omkara is a name for all of this, the Omkara actually it's called Pranava, that's a name for the Omkara, because Omkara is sacred. So the Pranava, the Omkara, throughout the Vedas and the Vedanta, the Omkara is the most sacred syllable. Everything starts with Om, in fact. You know, any prayer that we do, any blessing, it always starts with Om. And any chant that you do, it'll always start with Om. So Om is the most sacred syllable, because this Omkara is a name for all that is. And so this Omkara then also, being a name for all that is, through teaching, using the Omkara as a teaching methodology, going through the four matras, means the four letters, or the four letters of the Omkara, the four syllables of the Omkara, by going through that, we are actually going through and explaining, you know, all that is Brahman. So when they say Chatushpat, what's going to happen now is that we're going to have to go through all of these four padas, and it'll start with the first pada. Let me just talk about that for a minute, and then I want to talk more about the Abhidhamma-Abhideya relationship. We touched on it last week, but not sufficiently. So if we say that the Omkara, we have Brahman, first of all, Brahman, which is mind, very being, which is all of this, we have to now analyze how can Brahman be all that is. Because we have here, and we're going to analyze it in this way, in terms of the totality of your experience, if we just go through the cycle of it one day, you will go through, in a 24-hour period, you will go through what we call the waking state, where you are awake to this world, which you are experiencing through your sense organs. Okay? And so if I look at myself from the standpoint of the Atma, I'm putting emphasis on myself as the waker of this waking state. Me, the conscious being, in the waking state, I will identify myself as the waker. Okay? Then if I go to the dream state, from the standpoint of the Atma, I will look at myself as the dreamer of the dream. Okay? So there's the dreamer and what is dreamt. There's the waker. So we can say like this. There's the waker and the world. The universe of the waker. The world of the waker. So there's the waker and the waking state. So this is the waking state, which includes the waker. Right? That's important. So the Atma, if I'm looking at the Atma, which in fact is Brahman, we have to look like this. And Brahman is all of this. So Brahman, which is all of this, is the waker, is the self of the waker, is the Atma. But now here, in this world, in this waking state, I am the waker. But this I is also the I, which is Brahman, and Brahman is the I, not only of the waker, but of the whole world of the waker, right? And so that's where we're going to have to go there. So we have here in this waking state, I am the waker of the waking world, and both the waker and the waking world is Brahman. And Brahman is the self. Okay? So that's going to be the first pada. The second pada, and so Om, the Om, I'll make the relationship in a minute. So this is the first pada. And Om, the of the Om, will be the first mantra. Let me get to that in a minute. Then we go to the second pada. What is your second type of experience? Is the dream state. How do we understand the dream state? Is when I am having an experience which does not involve my sense organs. My mind is awake to an experience, but there is no relationship with my sense organs or sense perception. So this is all going to be called bahishpragna. It's when the consciousness is related to what is being perceived through the sense perception. It's just a gross world. Okay? But when I dream, even though the dream is dependent upon what we call vasanas or perceptions or experiences I've had in the waking world, when I'm in the dream state, the waking world is not present for me. Now I'm in a subtle realm. I'm in the dream world. But I take myself to be the dreamer. The Atma is the dreamer of the dream world. Or within the dream world, I'm identified with a dream character within the dream world. Right? And so I'm the dreamer, and this is the dream world. So Brahman is all of this. Brahman is all of this. And myself is Brahman. Right? And so myself, then, is the self not only of the dreamer, but of the dream world. So that has to be enfolded, that Advaita, between Brahman, which is yourself, in its relationship with the dream world, be non-dual, you know, has to be unfolded in the second pada. So now let's go to the third pada. The third pada is in the deep sleep state. You know, because that we have waking state, dream state, where I'm having it, and you can extend. You know, the dream state, it just includes all of those experiences that you're having that are not generated at that time by sense perception. That's the dream state. You know, so the dream state can be extended just to include those subtle experiences that don't depend upon sense organs, even though many of them were generated by sense perception at an earlier time. The causal state, the third pada, right, is the deep sleep state. And in the deep sleep state, that's very interesting, because in the deep sleep, there is no subject-object relationship. There's no knower-known. So in that state, there is no way to differentiate. There's nothing to differentiate between like the dreamer and the dream state or the waker and the waking state. And so there's nothing in that state to differentiate, you know, that causal condition of Ishwara, the Ishwara or of the whole, and the causal condition of the jiva, because there's no differentiation into subject and object. So that's the third pada. The fourth pada, which we call Turiya, is, as we'll see, the very nature of consciousness itself, which is going to be found as the very being of the waking state, the dream state, and the causal state, but from its own standpoint, is just pure consciousness. So that's why we say fourth. But it's really not fourth, because if Brahman is this, is the waking, if Brahman is the waking state, the dream state, and the causal state, then Brahman by itself, where is the fourth, really? Because there's only one Brahman there. But if I look at Brahman from its own standpoint, just as pure consciousness, it's not consciousness of something. And so that Brahman in its own right has to be understood. And so we say it's the fourth. The Swamiji will say, it's the fourth like a dollar bill. Like a dollar bill is the fourth when we say four quarters. Now, but the four quarters make the $1. It's not like, when Shankara says, it's not like, you know, four legs of a cow. It's like four pot is four quarters of a dollar. And that dollar, that whole, is one Brahman. But if I differentiate Brahman, the self, the Atma, from these three different states, waking, dream, deep sleep, what I recognize is that the waking state is displaced by the dream state. Right? When you're awake, you're not dreaming. But when you're dreaming, the waking state experience is not there for you. The one who is waking, who is awake, is the one who is dreaming. Right? Because when I wake up from a dream, now I'm in the waking state, and then I say, oh, I had an incredible dream. Or in the deep sleep, I'll say, I slept so well I didn't know anything. I'm describing these states as my states. I, the one who had the dream, is now describing the dream that I had. So now what's interesting, I say we take all this for granted. You say, I the waker am the dreamer and the deep sleeper. But the waking state is totally, the waking state comprised of the waker and the experience of the waker are totally absent in the dream state, which will have a different dreamer and dream experience. And so when I'm dreaming, that dream state displaces the waking state. And even the dream character, you know, I can take on any type of character, in the dream state, and for me, I am that character. Say you're having a dream and you're identified with a character, you are that character. But that character that you are in the dream state is not the character that you are in the waking state. But it is. So what that means is that the waking state character is a dress, as is the dream state character. It is a dress. When you're in the dream state, the waking state dress has been left behind, and you've taken on the new dress of the dream state. Right? So this is the situation. This is that anvaya vyatireka logic I'll do again in a minute. And if you look at the waking state is totally displaced by the dream state, and then in the dream state, then if you go to the deep sleep state, there's no waker or dreamer, nor is there any subject-object relationship. There's just nothing. There's just a big I don't know without even the words, because the mind is in causal condition. And so when you get back from that waking state, right, then you say, oh, I slept so well. You know, because you have a mind that can chit-chat now and describe things, but you can't in the deep sleep state. You can't describe anything.
Oh, I put it on the
You can't describe, you can't, I thought, uh-oh, okay. you can't describe anything because the mind's in a manifest condition. But you own it when the mind's awake, right? And so, that being so, you have to say that your being, yourself, the self that you are, not somebody else, the self that you are is equally present in all three experiences, which means that your being is not the three experiences. In this sense, your being is present in all three experiences, but has to be differentiated from all three, because the experience of yourself, right, is not dependent upon anything that you had taken to be yourself. Like, for instance, when I go from the waking state to the dream state, in the waking state, I had taken me, the Atma, the Ayam Atma, this Atma, which is Brahman, the self that I am, I had taken it to be one with the body, mind, sense organs. This person. I am this person. And therefore, since I am this person, when this person, this body dies, then I die. When this mind is sad, I am sad. When my sense organs are functioning, my sense organs work, or my sense organs are not working. See what I mean? So there's an anyonya adhyasa, a mutual superimposition between my mind, myself, the Atma, the conscious being, the aparoksha Atma, and the body, mind, sense organs that I experience. But if I look at what is left of me, when I go into the dream state, what is left of me? What is there? Because the body's not there in my experience. The mind is not there. It means the thoughts, the waker, anything about the waker, the body, mind, sense organs that relates in this world, that upadi, that conditioning, what we call that conditioning agent, is not part of the dream experience. See that? But I am there. So, who's there? I'm awake to the waking state, and I'm awake to the dream state. Who is it? Who is the me? Because you can say like this, well, my body is still there sleeping. Yeah? But the body is not being experienced. You have to look at who is the one that remains aparoksha as your very being that you take to be you, that has this anuvritti, this going through the three states, and what is left behind. Okay, in the waking state, what is left behind when I go to the dream? The waking world is left behind, and the waker is left behind. The body, mind, sense organs, experience are left behind. When I go to the dream, what do I have? Now I have a dream world with a dream body, with dream sense organs, and dream world of experience. This state of experience negates the waking state of experience, but I'm still here. And now, what about when I go to the deep sleep state, where I am, but now at this time, there's no subject-object relationship. There's no knower. This is important. I am the conscious being that I am, but I'm not knowing anything. Now what that says is I can be without knowing anything. The consciousness, conscious being, is conscious being, but not conscious being of something. For me to be conscious being of something, I need a mind and sense organs. But consciousness, the conscious being illumines the mind. When the mind is there, it is known. When the mind which is using the sense organs is known, right? Because illumined by consciousness, then I have this waking state. But me, the conscious being, when the mind goes into it, when it goes into a swapna, into a dream state, now the conscious being, I am there illumining the dream state. And I identify with the waker, which is really part and parcel of the dream state. But that is displaced by the deep sleep state, which is a causal condition. When the mind and sense organs go into a causal state, then me, I am still there, but the mind isn't doing its function of knowing, thinking, feeling, imagining. It's in a causal condition. And the sense organs are also in causal condition. So the ones that are responsible for the knower known, those are in causal condition. So then just me is there, plus the mind in causal condition. And when the mind comes awake into the waking state, then the mind will talk to you. If you ask it, what's it like when you're in the deep sleep state? Because now your mind is awake and it can do all this inquiry. Well, you know, when I'm in deep sleep, it's really wonderful actually, because at that time I don't know. I don't know anything. You know, I just sleep so deeply, you know. It's just I just love to just be in that type of a deep sleep. Edward always says, I love more than anything my deep sleep.
I vote for deep sleep.
I love my deep sleep. You also have the experience as you wake from deep sleep. You know when you have that experience, you're waking from deep sleep, the mind is coming out of that causal condition. What does it want to do? Sink back into that for a little while. Just kind of enjoy, you know, just being with myself. See how much we can talk about it? It's because the mind is awake, you know. And so the mind can comment. The mind is still going to have a vritti. It's called a very ati sukshma vritti. Because the mind itself is sattva, so it goes into a causal condition. When it wakes up, it can talk to you about that condition that it had. But now, when I'm awake, I'm not deep sleeping. Right? And when I'm dreaming, I'm not awake. These conditions negate each other, but they don't negate me. I'm the self of all three conditions. So that self, when I look at that Atma, the self, from its own standpoint, the one who in fact doesn't go to sleep, Atma, consciousness, doesn't go to sleep. Consciousness is consciousness, you know. It doesn't change its conscious being, doesn't change at all. So with the discovery of the Upanishads, using this prakriya of the analysis of the Omkara, which is the Abhidhana, the name for the Abhideya, what we discover is that the constant in all three states of experience is the self, which is Brahman. Why do we say this Brahman? First it starts out saying all of this is Brahman. Brahman is all of this. You know? Because when we analyze our experience, the one who is present to all three states, you know, is the being, is the self of all three. And so now the analysis between the relationship between these experiences and the self which is present, it's not just the self of one state of experience, it's the self of all states of experience. What is the relationship between these states of experience, which includes the waking and dream, includes subject-object, and myself? So the whole, there's two major prakriyas. I think I said this in the first class. One prakriya, one teaching methodology here that's being dilated is what we call karya karana. Karya karana, karya means the effect. Karana means the cause. cause-effect relationship, because I have one self, which is all of this. Brahman is all of this, and Brahman is also the causal condition, right? So we have Brahman, which is all of this. Then what is the relationship between Brahman and all of this? So Brahman is then the cause of all this. Brahman is the cause of all of this. It's the very being of all of this. But what is the relationship then between Brahman and all of these experiences that we have? So it's going to be Karya Karana, where we see Brahman is the material cause, in a sense. Material cause. But what is the relationship? Does Brahman change into all of this? Like in the waking state, does Brahman morph into the waking state and then morph into the dream state and then morph into the deep sleep state? You know? Or if it doesn't, if Brahman doesn't morph, right? Because you have to think of it like this. If it says Brahman, the conscious being, infinite conscious being, is all of this, there is no, so if I say, just think of these words, Brahman is all of this. Okay? So it already is all of this, all that is. It is even what is not manifest. It is all of this, and it is the causal condition also. So it already is everything that is, in past, present, future also. And so where is there a place for Brahman to morph, to change? Because there's already no place where Brahman is not. If something is all that is, then there's nothing left. So say you take the waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, the causal condition, and you say that Brahman, consciousness, is all of this. Then for Brahman to change, it's already there. See what I mean? Where is it going to change to? Because there's nothing that's not already that. And so, if that's the case, if Brahman already is all that is, including what comes in past, present, and future, then the relationship with Brahman and what is experienced is what we call the relationship of satya-mitya. Okay, so that's going to be a big discussion throughout the Upanishad. The relationship, the karya-karana, the cause-effect relationship between consciousness or between Brahman and what is, if we say it's satya-mitya, that means all of these names and forms that are experienced have for their very being one Brahman. Now, then we have the satya-mitya means if we use the clay pot, for instance, if we say that the clay pot, the upadana karana, the material cause of the pot, is clay, right? If I have a clay pot. So like that, I say the material cause, what is actually here in this waking state, is Brahman, is conscious being, the Brahman which is my very self. And let me just say another thing about that. If we say that the Atma, yourself, is Brahman, right? And Brahman is all of this, then like the clay pot, right, that Brahman must be me. Because Brahman is all of this and I am here. I'm not separate from all of this. So this body and sense organs, right, which is part of this waking state, is part and parcel of all of this. Right? And so, but it says, Brahman is all of this. So if this body, mind, sense organs, which exists just in this room, in this waking state, right, fits into all of this, right, you're not left out. So if you fit into all of this, then you must be Brahman. Right? Because otherwise, you're not here. Okay? Right. And that's why it says, you know, Brahman is all of this, and you are that Brahman. But then you have to understand, this is that Brahman. This is that Brahman, because Brahman is all of this. And so, now I have to be able to say, That's why it says right at the beginning, this Brahman, which is all of this and is past everything in the past, present, and future, and beyond that all also. That is, it's first it says Om is all of this. It is past, what is in past, what is in present, what is in future. It also is what is in the causal condition, unmanifest condition. It is everything. Brahman is all of this. And this is what's going to be, and the Om is all of this. Then it goes right away and saying, instead of using the Atma, instead of using Om, it says, and all of this, which is the Om, is called Om, and all of this is Brahman. Right? So all of this is Brahmana, all of this is Om. Om is the Abhidhana for all of this, which is Brahman. Yeah, that's where it starts. And then it says, and this Brahman, right? This Ayam Atma is Brahman. Why would this Atma be Brahman? Because Brahman is all of this. And so there's no place for me else for me to be. Wherever I go, it is Brahman. So now, if wherever I go, it is Brahman, then and I say, I am, I exist, right? Then I can't have an amness or an existence that is away from Brahman. You see what I mean? And so then, I have to then learn, well, how can I be Brahman who is all of this? Because I, this body, mind, sense organs, am not the waking state, I experience the waking state. Yeah, but the waking state that you experience is Brahman. And so now the experiencer, the Atma, the body, mind, sense organs, and the experienced, both are Brahman, and Brahman is you. And so what is my relationship then of me, who is Brahman, with this world of experience? And so this karya-karana, this cause-effect relation, like the upadana karana, the material cause, like the clay pot, and its relationship to all of this has to be unfolded to where you see, like it's very easy when you think of clay pot, I can say, the pot is only clay. I can say, the pot is clay. Okay? And you say, yes, the pot is clay. Then if you can say the pot is clay, right, because that's all it is, then what you have to say is that the pot, this pot, is a nama. It is a nama. It is a name for clay. Right? That's why last week I used the bas relief example. Like if you take a big, like a rectangular block of clay, and you carve into it an intricate scene, right? Then actually, even though we have nama, we have so many names, like we have a nama, a name for horse, right? A name for bullock cart, a name for store, a name for woman, a name for child, a name for dress. We went through all of this, a name for person. But all of these really, in the end, the analysis, are names, they're namas for clay. Because the truth of each one of those objects, right, is only clay. Right? And so this is the satyam mitya reality, the mitya that is that which is totally dependent for its being on clay. And here, the mitya is all of this, all of these namas, all of these names. Nama means name, nama, rupa, rupa is form. We think, see, when we say nama-rupa, name and form, we look at this creation and we say, this whole creation is nama-rupa, it's name and form, right? And then we'll think like this. Every form has a nama. Like if we say this, this is a little table. So the nama, table, goes to this, right? And then I could say, desk, the nama, the name desk, refers to this. This is the rupa. So nama, rupa, desk, rupa, the actual desk, name and form, right? So now look at this. This is how we function in the world. all of the names that we have attach themselves, indicate a rupa, a given form. Right? So even as an ajnani, I don't have knowledge of myself. If I say the word I, then it will attach to this rupa. I am this, you know. Or I can have the word body can attach, will attach to this, this physical body. You see what I mean? So what we're used to when we think of nama rupa, right? We're used to the nama, the name, attaching to the rupa. But now think of the bas relief complex scene that is carved into it, you know. There when you say the word horse, the word horse goes to the rupa horse, right? The word child goes to the rupa child, okay? Just like here. But what is really the horse? And what is really the child? What is the truth of the horse? What is the truth of the child? What is the truth of the sun? What is the truth of the clouds? What is the truth of the air? Is really only clay. See that? And so really, all of these namas are only namas of clay. Okay? We think it's nama rupa, but really, the substance of every rupa is only clay. And so actually, there is nothing there but names for clay. Right? Clay is what is. And so we have the word horse for clay, child for clay, because there are infinite number of rupas, of forms, as though, but really the infinite number of forms are just forms of clay for which we have names. You see that? And so there really is nothing there. The namas, every nama is only a nama of clay, right, in terms of what is actually there. And so here, this is the situation. Every nama is really just a nama for consciousness. We can say that there are forms here, you know, but upon analysis, like, look at all of these different forms. But really, all of these are names. Any nama that you have, I use this one this often. This is the nama lamp for this. But it's really only a nama, a name, because there is no real lamp here. This is just a name for a conglomerate of different things that are infinitely divisible. Right? That's where we go to this base and all this and the filament. It's just, you can divide this infinitely until it totally disappears. And in the end, what you have as what is actually here in terms of substance is consciousness. Just like what is actually in the clay, in the bas-relief sculpture, is clay. Right? So that's why that clay, the bas-relief, is such a beautiful example, because it's so easy for you to see. If I say, okay, there's horse clay, there's child clay, there's dress clay, there's sun clay, there's cloud clay, there is only clay. So here I can say there is person consciousness, there is rug consciousness, you know, there's table consciousness, there's shirt consciousness, there's jiva consciousness, means this individual. But all that is really here is consciousness. And that consciousness I am. That consciousness which is Brahman, that Brahman I am. So now the thing is, when we're using the Omkara, we're using the Omkara, the word Om, as a teaching methodology, a teaching methodology for the unfoldment of this fact that all that is here is only Brahman. There is nothing here but Brahman, and this Brahman is you. That's the methodology. And so when we look at it, right? Om has three padas, om. And if you recognize when I say om, and an u is a diphthong, right? So an u makes o, and then the makara. So a u m. If I say Om. That Om is surrounded and pervaded by the silence in which it rises. Right, so what comes before, when I say Om, what comes before and what comes after is silence. Right? And what is present in the Om, as the Om rises, it rises in silence, is pervaded by silence, and resolves into silence. So when we do japa, if you say Om, 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 you recognize that the Om is taking place in silence. It rises in silence, it is sustained in silence, and it resolves into silence. That silence is the turiya, is the Brahman. Right? And so the A is the waking state, U is the dream state, Makara stands for the causal, the deep sleep state. And each one of these letters, A, U, M, is going to be unfolded, like why should A represent the waking state? Why should U, you know, be the dream state? Why is the Makara? Why does that indicate the causal state? And then they'll say Om as we get into this, you know, the letter Om. In Om, beginning that, and I talked about this last week, Om, the A, is your first sound. Ah. If you just open your mouth and make a sound, it's ah. If you constrict, ooh, it's middle. Ah, ooh, mm, is the last sound you can make. So within Om, ah, ooh, mm, are all sounds. It's like the first sound in the Sanskrit alphabet and the last sound. Ah, mm. So all sounds, all letters, fall within a-um-um, a-u-um. And the a rises from silence, so a-um-um, the waking state, the u, the dream state, m, the deep sleep state. A stands for all namas. The included in om would be all namas, all sounds, all syllables are included. So that means all the namarupas, all names are included in om. And then the A, U, M stands for the waking, dream, deep sleep. We'll see that later, how, you know, go into detail how that is, how the waking, dream, deep sleep is represented by these three, you know. And you'll see that Om really represents all of the namas, right? And that Om is Brahman, right? That Om represents all of the namas, and all namas are only Brahman. And so what you have here is Brahman with an infinity of names. So instead of this is this, this, this is Brahman, this is Brahman, this is Brahman. So we have Brahman table, and we have the desk Brahman, you know, desk Brahman, table Brahman, chair Brahman, you know, Brahman, all namas are just names for one Brahman. There's a little, we'll go into the next, third verse next time. There's still a little bit more. Swamiji spent, just to let you know, and that in this, he spent 12 talks before he even got to the third verse. Wow. Because Shankara spent a lot of time setting this up. So I want to spend the time to, there's certain logics and things. We're getting to the end of it. But just to sit in this for a while, and the relationship between the Abhidhamma and the Abhideya and all of these things. So there's a lot of new terms also. So we'll go into the third verse next time. Where in the third verse, he immediately starts with what he calls the Pratimaha Pada, Pratimaha Pada, the first, you know, the first state of experience, the waking state. This is the Pratimaha Pada, and he'll look at it, you know, first from the Brahman, the state of experience, and then we'll also look at it from the Akara of Om. So anyway, by the time we finish the Mandukya, Om will have a great deal of meaning, because the whole Upanishad is really an Om. Okay, let's just take a minute.
Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Hi Jagadish, hi Chris, hi Rob, hi Maju.
Why does Brahman get the definition of the word silence?
No, he doesn't get it. Well, because
in reference to
a sound, any nama, any sound, any syllable, any letter, right? It rises from silence. Right? If the sound isn't there, then there's silence. But you understand that the silence also is that which in which the sound takes place. Because if the sound wasn't taking place in silence, there'd be too much noise to hear the sound. Mm-hmm. So sound has to take place in silence. So it rises in silence, it sets in silence. The creation rises in Brahman, it sets in Brahman. Mm-hmm. Brahman has no sound. Right, so silence itself is a good it's a good metaphor. A good image for Brahman. Metaphor. But the thing is in the creation you recognize in all of your experiences all taking place in silence. We always think of silence only in relation to sound. Mm-hmm. Like for instance, when you start with japa, if you were saying just like om, om, silence, om, om, om. And so you think initially just in that it's sound, silence, sound, silence, sound, silence. But one of the most powerful things about japa is if you do that for a little while, what you recognize becomes that viveka takes place, of discrimination, where you actually realize that the silence, nothing ever happens to it, that all sound takes place in silence. Okay? And then you look at the very nature of the silence that is not in relation to sound, but is the very presence in which sound takes place. Then you recognize that is the silence of your being. Right? Because sound is a part of duality, right? And all of our experience really is always in relationship to something else. Like happiness is in relationship to sadness, right? So when I'm happy, you know, then I'm not sad, and when I'm sad, I'm not happy. Or when there's sound, right, there's not silence. When there's silence, there's not sound. It's always within these opposites. But what we recognize that even in terms of joy and sorrow, in ananda, in fullness and sadness, that underlying that, the very nature of the silence, which is Brahman, is not sad. And it's also not the fluctuating joy. It's the joy that is beyond the wholeness or the fullness or the happiness, all of these words, that are beyond duality, the one that is the very substrate to all the changing experiences. And the nature of that is what we call ananda, or fullness, or infinite being, you know. And so that is that's where we have to, in the whole teaching methodology, we have to use the words that themselves are very tied to duality. All the namas go along with rupas, nama rupa. Every word that you have is a word that is a word for something that is existing within duality that can be differentiated from other things, like consciousness, unconscious. Or, I am conscious, this is inert. So I'm differentiating now consciousness, I am a conscious being, and this is not a conscious being. But what about the consciousness which underlies the difference between conscious being and unconscious being? All of that takes place in consciousness. Now, that consciousness can't be negated because it's the consciousness in which both conscious and unconscious exist. And silence can't be negated, like that consciousness can't be negated by what is inert. But that needs to be taught, right? Because you come into this creation, into this duality. Right? And so you only know consciousness in reference to unconscious. And you only know sound in reference to silence.
But this silence, it's not a lack of sound. It's different than that.
No, it's not a lack of sound because it's the silence in which all sound takes place. Mm. It can be differentiated, you know. So right now, in fact, we do meditations on that to help you as you're listening to the sounds. Like say if you're just sitting quiet, it's a good meditation, you just sit quietly and you let all of the sounds of nature and the rustle and this and that, whatever sound is there, and you notice that all of the sounds are taking place in silence, the silence of your being. And that your being is never disturbed by sound at all.
And then a lack of sound is still silence.
And silence is not, the silence of your being is not disturbed by sound or the lack of sound. It's like saying, you know, silence takes place in silence and sound takes place in silence. The silence itself. Sorrow takes place in Ananda, happiness takes place in Ananda. Now if you say that, then you have to be able to differentiate, especially with sukha-dukkha, with pleasure and pain. What is the nature of the Atma, the self, in which pleasure and pain take place? I am happy, I am sad. But the I is the one that is the self of the happiness and the self of the sadness. That's why I say, I am happy, I am sad. So what is the swarupa, the nature, you know, of me? The one who is present to sukha and dukkha, pleasure and pain. That needs to be differentiated because that sukha, that ananda that we're talking about is different than the pleasure and pain that come and go. Or the silence and noise that come and go. So this is what we call viveka. Differentiating my experience, you know, between what is the stable constant in which all of this samsara, all of the change is taking place, you know. And then who is that one, you know. And that is me, that is Brahman.
But they say that the Brahman is Sat Chit Ananda. There's no reference to silence in that definition, is there?
No, but when you say Om, we're using silence. But that Sat Chit Ananda existence isn't talking, right? All sound takes place in Maya, the Maya Upadi. So. Brahman's not making any noise, right? So just by the fact that it's not making any noise, it's silent. But that silence, which is the very nature of Brahman, you know, is present in noise. Silence is present in noise. And silence is present in the lack of noise also. It doesn't mean that Brahman... If you say Brahman is silent, see, this is why these words, why there's teaching methodology isn't so important. Because for you, when you say silence, it's always in relationship to sound.
Yeah.
Right? And so I have to say, Brahman is the silence that in which the sound takes place and the silence in which silence takes place.
Yeah.
Brahman is the ananda, the wholeness in which sorrow takes place, and the wholeness in which happiness and joy and all of the emotions take place. And you are that Brahman. So there has to be a lot of discussion, you know, to be able to, it's all different. Discussion means not just head. You know, the words have to, in the whole teaching methodology, as these words are taking place, your mind, they're pointing to your experience. And so as the words have to be landing on your experience, so you should be thinking, oh, it's not just a theory. It's not just a theory. The words are trying to point to yourself and the territory so that you recognize it as it's being said. That's why the Vedanta is a pramana. It's a means of knowledge, not for indirect knowledge, but for direct, immediate knowledge. If it were just for indirect knowledge, that's about a lecture, you know, like a lecture giving you knowledge of this thing called Brahman, you know, which is away, which is paroksha, it's away from you. It's not away from you, it's right here. Like even the whole satya-mitya relationship is this, it is right here, to be recognized. So the words are just pointing, so you can, oh, you're seeing it. It's pointing to yourself, and you're like, it's true, I am self-evident, there's, because of me, everything is illumined. They're not, nothing's illumining me, I'm the luminary of all things, actually. And there's nothing behind the luminary, the consciousness. So these are just all things to be immediately, directly recognized. That's what Vedanta is. A Vedanta is a pramana, it's not a lecture.
Carol, I got with this, listening to this, that it's kind of a different, really is a different methodology than like the seer scene.
Oh.
I mean, it's obviously, it's not in any conflict with it, of course. But, you know, it's different than the seer scene or the Panchakosha.
Well, what it is called, I only did the Karyakarana right now, and I didn't get to the second one. Remember I said two? Right. It's called the Avastha Traya Sakshi. Mm-hmm. The Avastha Traya means a group of three. Avastha Traya, the group of three experiences, states of experience. So Avastha, we translate as state of experience. The waking Avastha, Jagarita Stana, we'll see this in the third. The waking state is one Avastha. The dream state is the second Avastha, state of experience. The deep sleep is the third. So that's the trial, waking, dream, deep sleep, states of it. These three states of experience. I am the Sakshi, the conscious being present in all three states. That's the, like the Drisha.
That's like it. But the way this starts, though, it's kind of different because it's, I guess, because of the Karana Karaka.
It starts with, it just drops a bomb.
Yeah, because it has this, all brings the whole idea of the totality of everything.
Exactly. It
so
starts
no longer, it's not so much like you're going in to find the self. It's more you're just looking at the totality of everything.
First it says you are all of this, and then you're kind of left, well, how is that? And then it'll start analyzing it. So it starts with this, you are the whole.
And it takes away all the, you know, the solidity of all the differentiations we make in the world of name and form and everything completely, to give you a glimpse of just the totality.
Totality, that's right. It's a pure, it starts with pure Advaita, non-duality. There is nothing here but Brahman. Everything is Brahman, and that Brahman you are.
And then we go to the witness?
Yeah, then we're going to go and analyze all three states of experience. But even though it does this, Avastha Traya Sakshi, its primary prakriya, teaching methodology, is this Karya Karana, cause-effect, satya-mitya.
Mm.
Yeah, because without understanding satya-mitya is clay pot, right? Without understanding that there isn't a second thing, that all of this is only Brahman, then there's no non-duality.
Yeah.
I feel a little confused by the causal state, just because the way that you used it in terms of the mind in dreaming, but also that Brahman, that is also where, just the relationship between the way that
you know why,
because
why you're having trouble is because in the classes that you've been here so far, we haven't really gone into the causal state. Like, for instance, what we would say, just that what we call maya is that kind of a creative capacity that has no independent reality apart from Brahman, is responsible for the manifestation of the creation. And so the whole creation manifests, is sustained, and it resolves. Okay? So it comes from a causal condition, which we call maya. And the self of that causal, of that maya, is Brahman. Okay? So Brahman with this maya, which is causal, it's causal because the creation rises and sets into it. That's what makes it causal. So like your waking state rises and sets into a deep sleep state that is different than you, than consciousness. right? In the mind, it's the mind going into a causal condition. So the whole universe goes into a causal condition, at which is illumined by awareness, right? So the awareness is differentiated from the causal condition. The causal condition is causal to the waking state and the dream state, or to the universe when it's manifest, or the universe when it's in an unmanifest condition. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
there is a relationship between the way, between those two, between the way that reality rises and sets and the way that your experience rises.
Exactly. Yeah. For the dreamer goes through that causal condition from coming into the waking state to the dream state back into the causal state. But the whole universe comes from the causal condition of the whole universe becoming manifest. But for you, that causal condition takes place on a daily basis. But the whole creation takes place over billions of years, the manifestation and the that's where that is all Vedic.
Is that a cosmology resolution, or is that part of the pramanas?
It's the cosmology that's taught in the Vedas, but when you're understanding the nature of this reality, it's very much a part of it. But for it to be viable, or for you to really understand it, you have to start with the seer-seen differentiation. Because if you understand clearly one thing, then the next thing is logical, right? So but without understanding your own being, the nature of consciousness itself, that next step, your next step is not logical, you know? Like if I take consciousness, my conscious being, to be a knower, if I take consciousness to be in the form of the body, mind, sense organs, how then can I say that I am the consciousness of the table, you know? Or I'm the consciousness of all things, or that this whole infinite creation is nothing but consciousness? How can I say those things? And have your mind say yes. Your mind says yes because there's no other way it can be. If A is true, then B has to be true. There's not really any choice. See what I mean? And then C has to be true. So if A is understood, then this is the natural sequence. And in fact, you understand one thing that happens in the old teaching methodology that you think, oh, my teacher, how did she know, or how did he know I was thinking about that? I used to experience that all the time with Swamiji. It's like the teaching is unfolding, and then naturally a question would come. But the question is exactly the next thing they're going to talk about, because because this situation leads to this question. And so you just find your mind kind of going through its own process, and many times your teacher will be going through the exact process, because that is the logical sequence of your thinking. See? So we have to go through all that.
Yeah. What is the Sanskrit for causal?
Yeah, karana.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah. And there are other words too. Karana means cause. Karya means effect. So karana, cause, karya, effect. Now, for that causal condition, another word that we often use is avyakta. The word avyakta means unmanifest. So the karana, the causal condition, is often called avyakta. Vyakta means manifest, avyakta means unmanifest.
I don't really understand why, though, it's connected with the cause. Or
because in material cause, there's efficient cause. It's called nimitta. Karana, the efficient cause, the intelligent principle is the nimitta karana. The upadana karana is the material cause. So if I say, like clay pot, the upadana karana is the clay, you know. But then we have the pot maker, you know, which is the nimitta karana. So the pot maker is the intelligent principle, the guy that makes the pot, right? But the clay is the upadana karana. Here, when we're talking about Ishwara, Ishwara is both the nimitta and upadana karana, right? So, if we talk about like clay pot, just the clay pot, then the upadana karana, the material cause, is the clay, you know. And then there's the pot, so we have the cause, the karana, upadana karana, and its relationship to the effect. What is that relationship? Mitya. satya nityam. Because here, the karana, right, has the karya, the pot, the thing that's created, has no being at all apart from the cause. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so here, the karana, you can say the karana, upadana karana, is Brahman. You know, and the upadana karana has no, the karya, the effect, has no being at all apart from the cause. This is, we have to get into this later, but there's one other thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
The karya here is going through all kinds of change.
Yeah.
The creation, right?
Yeah.
It's just infinite change.
Yeah.
You know, infinite motion. Brahman, there's no motion. But we say Brahman because no change. It's just non-dual. It's just pure being. It doesn't have arms or legs. It's just pure consciousness. So how can pure consciousness be the upadana karana, the material cause of that which is always changing? We say it's the vivarta upadana karana. Vivarta upadana karana means it is the material cause, but itself goes through no change, like the rope snake, like the dream. So you have to bring in drishtanta illustration to show what you mean.
So that makes sense to me. Why though is causal connected though with this, kind of the deep sleep state or the unconscious kind of
because
state.
We experience it. Like for instance, when you go into deep, the mind goes into deep sleep, right? At that time, there the mind is in unmanifest condition, right? The same mind comes back out, and so that's what we mean by causal. It goes into it's causal or unmanifest condition. Because the same mind comes out.
Yeah, the unmanifest word makes sense to me for some reason, the causal. I mean, as opposed to Brahman being the upadana karana, that makes sense to me, but as far as, but this kind of...
Because it's causal condition, it's a, Brahman is avyakta, it's the parama avyakta, the supreme avyakta, unmanifest.
Okay.
But Maya is the avyakta, Brahman is the avyakta of the avyakta.
So it's like this undifferentiated ignorance kind of the cause of the whole, in a certain way.
It's
the cause of Maya.
Yeah.
The appearance.
They even have a new word for it. Say if we take upadana karana, which means material cause. Brahman is the vivarta upadana karana.
Mm-hmm.
Means it itself goes through no change at all. Maya is the parinama upadana karana. It is the material cause responsible for the manifestation of change. But when we analyze the Maya, which is the parinama, means that's what modifies. You know, when we analyze the nature of Maya, then we get to its etymology, ya ma iti Maya. That which is not, that is Maya. Means. The Maya itself, when we analyze it, it has no being, no independent being apart from Brahman. But it's manifesting, you know, as the creation and going into unmanifest condition, but it has no separate being. And then the Upanishad goes into this whole thing about a Nama also. Nama has no separate being apart from the Nami, the thing that's been named. What is its relationship? Does Nama just stand out there by itself as some entity? It's Maya, really, it's Mitya. It's a Nama, but the thing that is there is the Nami, the thing that's being named. So this is a major thing that's being discussed here in the Upanishad.
And when the creation goes into unmanifest condition, like in deep sleep.
Yeah.
Consciousness is still self-evident.
Consciousness is still self-evident. Why? People have a problem with it. Is you only think of consciousness as consciousness of something.
Yeah.
You know? But your mind has to be awake to be conscious of something. But you are just a conscious being. The me, you know, is never awake or asleep. It's always, you'd say, the me is always awake, if you want to use that word. But if we use awake, then it's wake versus asleep. But consciousness is, consciousness never becomes unconscious. You know, consciousness doesn't go to bed.
So self-evident doesn't mean that you have to be awake.
You don't have to be awake for self-evident consciousness. That's why you can get rid of, in the Chandogya, you roll up the whole universe like a piece of leather, and toss it to the side, and what is left is me.
Yeah, because see, my definition of self-evident it is always...
No, the self-evident, you just maybe have not recognized it yet. It's something that has to kind of, you have to wake up to it. It's like a, oh.
Okay.
You know, is the me, the very most personal sense of self, me, that is always present, is always present. And I'm not doing anything. I just simply am. And my being is ever-present. It doesn't modify or change at all. And it is everything. Not everything in terms of things, you know, but it is the truth of everything. And there's absolutely no pravritti or no inclination, desire, or wanting to change that at all. Because it is, I am that, me, is the truth of things. There's no inclination. If you say, do you want to be different? If you're talking about the me, no, I don't want these dukkha vrittis, I don't want these sorrows, and I don't want these emotions, and I don't want this situation here or that situation here. But I do want me. Just let all the situations change.
So there's not the urge to grow or to be mature?
There is, but that belongs to the mind. But you don't want to change the me. You want these conditions to change, you know. But to change yourself would be to lose yourself, you know. It's that you want the things that are, the things that do change, then you have raga dvesha, likes and dislikes toward them, or neutral. Let me change this, let me change that, let me make this better, let me make that better. But so that all the things are creating a beautiful environment for me. all these things honor me, you know, and just being perfect so that I can abide. But as the differentiation becomes clear, then yourself is not tainted in any way by all of these things. And then the mind learns all that and starts to relax. So until we understand that, we're out trying, you know, to make everything better for me. Because I need to be improved. Your mind needs to be improved in a way because the ajnanam is there, the ignorance is there that is creating so much tension for your mind because you have a lot of things that you believe that you need in order to really, you know, be okay. Like, and there are all things out here that are changing and so it's very precarious. You know, you can get these things but you can only get them for a while. They're all temporary. I think of old Tibby, you know, sometimes I'll pray, let Tibbs, you know, my cat, may she live a long life. I want her to be with me as long as possible. Because I know that this is just a gift that we have these beautiful things for just so long. So may she live, you know, a very long life so that I can enjoy her presence for as long as possible.
So
this, that appreciation comes only from the place of not being caught in the cause and effect kind of scenario, which is really driven by mithya.
Yeah, but you know that the mithya, that is its nature, mm-hmm. you know. Sometimes Bhagavan blesses you with some very beautiful things. Mm-hmm. He can say, you know, let her be long-lived so that I can enjoy her presence. But you also know, you know, that everything that we have here is time-bound. So the vairagya, what the vairagya is, mm-hmm. vairagya means a dispassion. And dispassion is not a negative thing. It's just that, you know, I can enjoy that presence while it is here. And when it is not, I'm fine. Because that's a reality. It's a reality, you know, it's something that's a maturity also, is to understand that. So that then you can really deeply, you know, participate, you know, and love the beautiful things that are here. And when they're not here, they're not here. That's the truth. That's the truth of your life, really.
Yeah, so this journey on personal growth, how is that connected to what you were just saying?
Is owning that, owning your, recognizing yourself. As you recognize yourself and you recognize that I am all of this, the mind changes in the sense that your mind gains peace. Yourself doesn't change, the world doesn't change, but the subjective suffering caused by not knowing yourself, that changes. You know? It's not like you wake up to a new self. You wake up to the tremendous relief that yourself is the constant, that you are Brahman, and that you are the Ananda that you've always been seeking. You are the wholeness you've always been seeking.
And so that urge for personal growth is not really relevant to what
it's only
saying.
it's relevant in this way that until you gain knowledge, you know, your whole life really is about fulfilling raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes, in the light of Dharma, for a Dharmic person, you know. And you're definitely a Dharmic person, or you wouldn't even be here. It's like one of the prerequisites of even wanting this knowledge. So what are the conflicts that you face are your likes and dislikes not being fulfilled in one way or another, you know, and then also the sacrifices you make for the sake of Dharma, right? For the sake of Dharma, we don't do some of the things we want to do. And we do many things that we don't want to do for the sake of Dharma. That's the life, right? And then the things that we like don't stay, and the things that we don't like do stay. When we don't have the free self inside, or the very source of the Ananda, because of that mutual anyonya adyasa, we don't have that. Because of that mutual superimposition, I haven't differentiated myself from all of the mind and body and sense organs. And so then I'm dependent for any type of shanti or peace or well-being on these momentary situations where everything is in alignment. But the world only stays in alignment for short periods of a time, you know. And even everything that I may cherish in a life will definitely eventually come to an end. You know, like say you have a loved one, you have children, say for instance, or you have a beloved partner that you've gone through your whole life with. Like I know my parents were at 55 years or something before they died, and then at the end of that life, my father once said, you know, I just take everything one day at a time. He said something like, one day at a time is a gift to have your mother here. You know, I mean, because you know you're at the end, you've Swarga Lokas like that, you may have been there for, you know, hundreds or thousands and thousands of years, but you get to that time when this beautiful experience is not going to be there. And you always know it, so there's always this underlying sadness. That's all the samsara. And that samsara is what you're relieved from. You know, because you, this is all Ishwara, and the ananda, the wholeness, is your very self. And so the mind, depending upon that wholeness, appreciates, you know, the things that...
Well, that's the dispassion you're talking about, the dispassion.
That's why dispassion is not a negative word.
Yeah.
It's a very positive word. It's like I can love freely because I don't need to cling. The dispassion is the non-clinging. You know, non-clinging means that I'm free to let things go and can totally enjoy them while they're here. That's what we mean by vairagya. Otherwise, sometimes people think of this vairagya as, you know, everybody stay away. I can't afford to get in any type of relationship with you. But that isn't it at all. I'm free to be in relationship because I'm free to let it go.
Especially because everything is Brahman.
Everything is Brahman, yeah. Exactly. You know, so there's nothing going, really. There is nothing coming or going, really.
So. You know, you were saying you don't just wake up to a new self, you know? And then I was thinking, it's true, and at the same time, you kind of wake up to a new relationship to that self.
Well, you wake up to the freedom of yourself.
Yeah. You kind of
but it's the same self. It's just you recognize, oh, I am free. I am free.
Yeah.
There's nothing that will ever change me, that can ever touch me at all, ever. And so then that's such a huge relief for your mind. You know? Now it has a home, which is its very being. You know? And then being at home, then it engages in the world. But engages in the world as Ishwara also.
And that's very different than trying to find your well-being in
totally
the
different.
Yeah.
We all are still trying to find our well-being in a mithya sense.
Yeah.
You know, like, I prefer a clean house to a dirty one. Or, you know, I like to get enough sleep so I'm not tired the next day. It's all relative. But there's that all relative stuff is taking place in something which is not relative. And, you know, myself is the same whether my house is dirty or not.
It's also
the same whether I'm tired or not.
It's also self-regulating in a certain way, right? I mean, it's like when you're sick, you recognize you need to do something to get healthy again.
Yeah, it's
well,
dharma.
If your house is dirty, you need to clean your house. So
yeah.
It's like,
but there's nothing happening with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Happily, you clean your house. Anyway, let's stop. Okay.
Good.